Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching from God's Word you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to Him. If you're ever in the Madison, Alabama area, we'd love for you to worship with us on Sundays at 8:30 or 10:30 a.m. If you have any other questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, find us at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to also check out our Bible study podcast, Madison Church of Christ Bible Studies. Thanks again for stopping by.
Twenty-eight years ago, I got my first job in ministry, and it was at the University Church of Christ in Montgomery, Alabama. And I was the youth minister there, and so excited. I was 21 years old, had no idea what in the world I was doing, but I wanted to come across as someone who knew what I was doing, if that makes any sense. And so one of the things that was beautiful about that group is we were small, and so we had really close relationships. And we decided together that we were going to grow. And so we worked hard and we got enough to be able to take a trip in the van where we could fill up the van for the first time. There were 15 of us that decided we were going to go on our first ever out-of-town trip. And we decided to go watch the Birmingham Bulls play hockey. It was an exciting time. The kids were fantastic. We got there. I told them we were going to, you know, be on top of all the details. I talked to the parents. I put together a beautiful sign-up sheet. I mean, I don't want to brag, but it was pretty impressive. I wanted to make sure that the parents knew the itinerary, where we were going, when we were going to arrive, what we were going to do while we were there, what time we should be expected to be back. And I tried to just put all of that thought and that detail into everything. I wanted to appear, at least in my mind, that I had some sense of control over what was going on. And I knew, being young, that that would be tough for parents to let me take their kids out. So I got on the church insurance and got in the van, and we headed off to the Birmingham Bulls. Interesting thing, as we were going along the way, we stopped at Pelham so we could get some, you know, food. And so we stopped at that really fancy restaurant, McDonald's, and went in there to get us some good grub. And while we were there, though, there was something interesting that happened. There were some guys outside the restaurant that were banging on the glass windows. And they were pointing at one of the kids in my youth group. His name was David. And they were just banging and inviting him outside to fight and all these things. I said, "David, what in the world did you do?" He said, "I didn't do anything, man. I was sitting there eating my cheeseburger." And truly, he was stress paralyzed. Like, he was holding his burger like this and just kind of staring out the window. And it kind of shocked him that they were coming at him so hard. And so he said, I'm scared. They want me to fight." I'm like, "Well, listen, man, they're not going to come into McDonald's and they're going to cause a scene. They're not going to do anything like that. Let's just control the situation. We'll stay in here. They'll eventually get tired. It's Saturday night. They're teenagers. They're going to want to go somewhere else and hang out. So you can count on them to move on." And sure enough, in about 5 or 10 minutes, those guys stopped banging on the window. And eventually they got tired of that. And they finally left and went wherever they were going. And so we packed our stuff up. Again, control. I've got this. And so we get into the van and we head over to the VBC. Not VBC, you know what I'm talking about, the Birmingham Jefferson Center. And we get there and we pull into a parking deck. And if you know anything about that area, there's a big parking deck. And then like a block away is where the arena is. And so we had to park the van and then walk down to the thing. And, you know, the whole way I'm thinking, I want them to feel the awesomeness of this moment. So I made sure I handed all of them their little tickets, you know, like, here's your ticket. I wanted them to be able to say, "Here's my ticket," you know, and that kind of thing, which was great. Instead of me just saying, "I got all these guys, here's your tickets," you know, I wanted them to feel it, you know, again, attention to detail. And so I send them through, and then we get there and we get into the arena, and they've already sung the national anthem. There's already like a lot of music playing and lights flashing everywhere, and it really, like, if you've ever gone to a hockey game to watch the Birmingham Bulls play hockey, it's fascinating. It's awesome. And I know we got a ton of people here who are hockey aficionados, and so I've seen some of these kiddos play, and they're really good too. But it was exciting, and we get into the arena, and all those lights are flashing, and we find our way to our seats, and it's good seats, and we're excited about what's going on. And I look around, and those kids are just like, "Whoa," you know. And so we sit down, and David, the one who was scared before, taps me on the shoulder. We had just got seated. He said, "Listen, I was scared to death back there. I threw my food away, and I'm still hungry. Do you mind if I go to the concession stand?" I'm like, "No problem, man." So no sooner had he said that, they dropped the puck, and with that, all of the players dropped their gloves, and it was a waylay fight for like 5 minutes. And so we're all like, whoa, and the crowd is going, nah! You know, they're like having the time of their lives watching these guys go at each other. They're fighting, and, you know, it goes on for a long time, and they finally get it calmed down and cleared up, and then they start playing hockey. And I'm mesmerized by the whole process. Like, and I look down, and I see the kids, and they're just like, ah, you know. And so we get a little bit further. And all of a sudden, the Bulls scored a goal, and so everybody goes crazy. And I look down, and I see that I have given these children the absolute moment of their lifetime, right? They are having a blast. And then it hits me, where's David? And I looked at Cindy, I said, have you seen David? She said, no, he's been gone a while. And I went, oh, no. So I get out of my seat, and I walk up the steps to try to find David. And when I turn around and walk up the steps, there is David standing at the top, walking down with, like, this real just anger in his voice. He's got a big old knot on the side of his head. He's sweaty. He's muddy. He's dirty. His clothes are ripped up. And he sits down in the chair, and I'm like, are you okay? And he kicks the seat in front of him. He's like, oh! He's got, like, this adrenaline rush going, and I detect it right away. I'm like, he's okay, something's happened. What in the world happened? He said, those guys that were at McDonald's followed us here to the arena, and they walked around till they found me in the concession stand, and they started pushing and kicking and hitting me. And so I fought back. Well, they saw me hit the guy, and they grabbed me and that guy, and they threw us out into Birmingham. Hello. Threw them out into the streets of Birmingham to finish their fight. Nobody came to find me, but fortunately, David had a ticket stub. David got back into the arena and walked over, and all this transpired in that, whatever that amount of time is, and he came down, and so I immediately, again, seized control. Everybody, listen up. No one goes to the restroom. No one goes to the concession stand. No one has anything without me and another adult with them. I got it. Everybody go. Okay, so we do that, and we have a good time. The game is great and all that stuff, and I think Birmingham won. No big deal. Anyway, so we are gathering everybody. I said, we are all going to the restroom on the way out. And so literally all of us adults stood outside the restroom doors and waited for the kids to come, and then we headed back to our van. Well, when we got to the parking deck, we went to a level that was too high, and we had to walk around to get down to the bottom. And as we're walking down to get toward the van, all of a sudden we hear more steps. Ch-ch-ch-ch. There they are. It's those guys again. And they came after us. And folks, if you grew up in my time, you remember what happens when Miyagi takes on Cobra Kai, right? And so what took place was this. This is actual footage. I was waxing on, waxing off, holding them down, putting them aside, and all those kinds of things. I thought I had control. But in reality, I had no control. Because, see, there are things and there are circumstances around us that the things that we want to control, maybe we can, but there are things all around us that are happening that make us out of control, make us out of the ability to control and to manipulate things the way we'd like for them to. And if we're not careful, we can take that into spiritual things, thinking, I know what I need to do. I know in my life what needs to happen, and I'm going to be working on these things, and I'm going to be pushing forward in my faith. I'm going to be doing these things, and I'm going to do these things down the road, and I'm going to have all this control, and I'm going to manipulate life exactly like I see. And the reality is, if we're not careful, we'll fall into the trap that thinks that we ourselves are the ones who are in control in life. But that's not the story in James. As we get into James chapter 4 and verse 13, this is the situation. He says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. How many of us have said that? Tomorrow I'm going to do this. We've all got calendars right in our phones, and we all have the daily routine and the things that we're going to be doing. We all have our schedules, and we're working those things, you know, every day, and we're pushing forward to things that are down the road. And he says, you know, you're saying today and tomorrow we will go to such a city, and we'll do this thing, we'll trade, and we'll make a profit. And yet he says, verse 14, you do not know what tomorrow will bring. Isn't that something to just stop for a second and for us to think, man, I do this all the time. I think about what's happening next and what I'm going to control next. And God sends a stunner through James in saying, yet you do not know what your tomorrow will bring. And he says, what is your life? For you're a mist. You're a mist that appears for a time and then it vanishes away. it's interesting that this book is so practical, and yet, you know, we keep saying that God is calling us higher. He's calling us to a deeper level of commitment to Him, and He zeroes in on the internal things that are occupying our mind that we're not even aware of it. Do we realize that when we do those things that we're actually thinking that we are in control of those things? And so he talks about boasting in our future, and listen to how it falls out. Today or tomorrow, assuming that there will be a tomorrow, we will go to such a place, assuming that we control the circumstances. We will spend a year, assuming that we determine the length, and we will make a profit, assuming that we are the source of our success. Isn't that interesting for us to think about life that way? I mean, I know we don't conscientiously think about that way, but when we're saying these things without recognizing God's power, we are kind of saying, I'm in control of these things. And so the directive is not to stop planning. It's not to not be looking forward. It's not to be working ahead or planning for the future and those kinds of things. It's just recognizing that day may never come. It's realizing that what I have in this moment is the thing that I'm to be blessed with and that I'm to be using for God's glory. So I don't look down the road in anticipation and thinking that all those things are going to happen. I plan ahead, but I recognize that the day that I'm given, that this day is God's blessing to use it for His glory. So we got to be clear on who it is that controls tomorrow. He says that life is uncertain. He says this in James 14, 4 verse 14, where it says, your life is a vapor or mist. So here's life described as a vapor mist. Then later in Psalm 78, a passing breath. And then later in 1 Peter 1:24, the idea of withering grass. Well, when I thought about all these things and I'm looking at how God sees life here, and think again in the scheme of eternity, you know, our life is, it's just a little bitty blip on that line. And so God views us as a life that's here for a short time, and our job is to glorify and honor Him. And he says all these things about uncertainty. So when I looked at those, vapor, mist, passing breath, withering grass, my mind went immediately to an old school NFL football game. Do y'all remember the Ice Bowl back in the frozen tundra of the Lambeau Field? You remember this? Oh, yeah. Some of us who are older remember that. Well, maybe not remember it, but we remember looking at it. Okay, remember seeing pictures of it and videos of it. In this photo are all three of those things. You've got like their bodies are emanating heat, and if some of these guys take off their helmets, steam comes piling out because it's so freezing cold in the stadium. And you can see their breath, and it goes there, and then it disappears. The steam is coming up off of their back, and it goes away. And then there's grass there, and it's been pounded by the cold and the elements and them running around. That grass is dead. And in that one image, I can see this illustration so beautifully that God is saying that your life is here for a moment, and then it's gone. And it's important what we do within those days. So how do we shape our mind differently? He says this, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. I've never thought of that as being arrogant. But he says this, all such boasting is evil. Take that into your mind just for a moment. That thought process that assumes that what we are doing is the most important thing, that we are in control of all outcomes, assumes that we haven't trusted in God. And so he says, whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, to him it is sin. What's he saying? You're here for a short period of time. You've got this life that I've given you. In this moment, stop worrying about what's taking place tomorrow. Use what you have in this moment. And if you don't take advantage of the opportunities that are right there in front of you, it's sinful. So like I think in my mind, your life is a mist. You're here for just a short time. Like, take advantage of today. Today is all we're promised. So look hard at your life and ask Him, is there anything that I'm putting off? Is there anything that I'm delaying? Is there anything that I'm not ready for? Because somehow I've made something here on earth to be more important than that thing. He says that if we don't do that thing, it's sin. What he's actually asking us to do is to give over our will for His. And when we yield ourselves over to Him, what happens is we give ourselves to the moments that He provides for us. Now, that's a beautiful thought, isn't it? Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10 says that we are His workmanship created by God in Christ Jesus to do the works that He has laid out in advance for us. Our God is so sovereign that He just keeps putting opportunity in front of us all the time. And He's saying, you got today. take advantage of what you have today and yield ourselves over to the moments that He provides. What happens when we do that? Well, a few things. First one is this. It stimulates a God is sovereign mindset, meaning I relinquish control. I recognize that God is the one who's directing my paths. The second thing it does is it opens our eyes to His work. We begin to see, in some ways, the things that He's doing in our lives, the opportunities He's putting in front of us, the ways that we can be a blessing to other people. We open our eyes and we see that God is manipulating things. He's putting things in place. The third thing is we no longer trust in ourselves. We begin to trust in what God says He will provide for us, the things that are most important. But then in that process, as we do see God giving us the things that we need, it actually builds this anticipation and hope because the greater promises are not here on earth, they're in eternity. And so it helps us get excited about what's yet to come in eternity when we can be in heaven with each other and all the people that we love, the people that have gone before us and the people that we've lost here in this life. He builds this anticipation of being with the Lord forever, and those are the greatest promises we could have, and yet we're still holding on to things here. So yielding over to God's will says, I want to fall in line with who He is. And what it does is it protects us from what I would refer to as power trips, thinking that we are the ones who drive all of life. And speaking of power trips, listen to the words in James chapter 5. Come now, you rich. And I love the way David Glenn read that this morning. Come now, you rich. I like the way he said that because I think that's the way it was written. Those of you who are rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming on you. That's pretty harsh. In other words, in my mind, as I read that passage, I think, does that mean riches mean sorrow? And of course, it does not. But it is about how we handle those riches. He says, there are miseries that are coming upon you. I think it's important that we go back to even what Jesus had to say about this. You know, James is really kind of repeating some of the same thoughts that you've heard Jesus say before. For example, Jesus said, what sorrow awaits you who are rich? For you have your only happiness now. You remember that passage in the Bible where Jesus is talking and he says, if you shout out loud and you're doing your good deeds and you're sounding the trumpet and you're having everybody look and notice you for the good things that you're doing, he says, you have your reward. That's kind of the same thought process of this idea is that if we put our trust in the riches that we have right now, what he's saying is that is the totality of your happiness. It doesn't get more than that. It's just that if that is what you consider your happiness, there's no more greater reward than that. That's it. That's it. That's all you get. But he also said this in Matthew 19, 23 and 24. I tell you the truth, it's very hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. I'll say it again. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. And of course, we've heard this all of our life, and there's so much that we could dig into even in that concept and that thought and that phrase that's used there. But ultimately, what he's saying is it's not so much about the riches that you have. It's the loyalty that you have to either riches or God. In other words, our problem is not that we have money. Our problem is that we trust in our money and that we don't put as much trust in God. So he says in verse 2, your riches have rotted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and your silver have corroded. Now in these times, I think you've probably heard this before. I know we've talked about it before. Their wealth was measured maybe differently than we would see it. If they were able to have a bountiful feast, if they were able to invite guests and have a big banquet and a big spread of food, that was considered to be some sign of riches and wealth. But then also their clothing was important. So if they had all these extra outfits besides just the one that they wore every day, if they had special occasion thing, then they were considered to be a little bit more well off. And then, of course, obviously, like the way we do, we collect coins and money and gold and silver and those kinds of things. If they collected those kinds of things and they had surplus of those things, then that was an indication of their wealth and their riches. And it's interesting that he says, your riches have rotted, that's food, your garments are moth-eaten, and your gold and your silver have corroded. If all that stuff is just sitting there in your overabundance and in your plenty and you're not sharing these things with other people and you're just harvesting them for yourself, then what happens is ultimately that food rottens. Those clothes get moth-eaten and those coins begin to rust and corrode a little bit. And he says this, it's interesting. Their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. Because you've laid up your treasure here in these last days. What's he saying? He's saying somehow something has changed and happened to where you have placed more emphasis on those riches than you have on God. Jesus said this, didn't he? And it's interesting that James uses this same terminology. But Jesus said, don't store up treasures here on earth where moths eat them and rust destroys them and where thieves break in and steal. Store your treasures in heaven where moths and rust cannot destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. What's he talking about? He's talking about like an eternal investment. He's talking about making certain that the things that are inside of us are focused on God and giving our hearts to him. So maybe this is a good time to just stop in the sermon and for all of us to take a moment to evaluate. Are we placing more emphasis in things of this world than we are of things that are of God? You know, when I say what I'm about to say, I don't want it to sound condescending or like we ever had it disfigured out. You know, our children had interests, okay? And it could be soccer, it could be baseball, it could be football, it could be band, it could be a lot of different things. And we tried our best to help support our children in those things. Like if they were developing those abilities, then we would try to get them good coaching or maybe extra training on the side or what have you. But after a while, you start realizing that that's kind of an endless thing. And if you're going to get to the next level, you got to keep pushing harder and harder and harder. And this, again, it's not to look down on anybody. There's nothing wrong with you getting that training, using your resources in that way to help your child, to support them and to develop them into what they need to be. But you got to ask the question, is your spiritual investment in your child equal or greater than those things? When you ask yourself, where am I spending all my resources, my time, my energy, my thought processes? Are those the kinds of things that we invest fully in and we let that be a thing because that's going to bring success and ability and scholarships and all those things? And that's just in the kid realm. We're not even talking about us as individuals, but how do we act in the same way? Do we invest in hobbies and different things that we want? Saving money. Do we make those things such a focal point in our life that we stop giving our heart to God and really investing in things that are more important? Are we guilty of making short-term decisions in exchange for long-term consequences? Again, not wrong to have those things, but are those things taking over our world to the point where God is sort of like if we have leftover time? We just need to be careful that we're not doing that. He says, behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. What I want you to understand here is there are a lot of people who have differing views on who James is talking to here. There are some people who say he's talking to Christians. There are some people who say, no, he's talking to other evil rich people outside of the church. But I think in this context, whether it's the person who is being oppressed or the person who is doing the oppressing, what he's saying is, what's happening is, I can see what wealth is doing in your life. And wealth is creating this sense of your power over someone. And he says, if you're doing these things, just understand that God is hearing the prayers of those people who are being oppressed, whether it be yourself or whether it be others that you yourself are oppressing. God sees that and he recognizes it. He says, the Bible says in Leviticus 19, verse 13, it says, you shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired worker shall not remain with you all night until the morning. What's he saying? Be fair to the people that you take care of. Don't let your wealth and your riches be something that you are able to hold over onto other people. James 5:5-6 says this, you have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. Again, he's talking about riches becoming oppressive to other people. Well, how can it become oppressive to other people? Look, it's okay for you to be prosperous. It's okay for you to be great in your job. It's okay for you to be paid well. What he's saying is if you know that there are people that are out there who are struggling, who are going through difficult circumstances, it is oppression when you see the need and you don't reach out to help that person. It is oppressive when you turn a blind eye to something that you could be responsible for and helpful to some people. He says in a weird kind of awkward way, what you're doing is you're having that person who is a Christian looking at you going, that's what Christianity is, someone who holds on to their wealth and they're self-indulgent and they're taking care of themselves, but they're not looking out for others. That's not what I want to be. And in doing so, you sort of send them to condemnation because they go, that's not, I don't want to be that. And not only that, but it's kind of oppressive in the situation where they don't know how to fight back. So they just kind of rot away. It's kind of a weird way to look at it, but he's saying that it can be oppressive to the point of killing these people in a sense, spiritually speaking. He says he does not resist you, saying he has no power, has no influence, and we're guilty of that. So James knows that some have felt the oppression, and he knows that some have been guilty of it. I guess the bottom line for all of us to realize is that we need to be careful that we're not guilty of such hostility. And I hate to say it that way, but that's really kind of the way he paints this here. So let's talk real quickly about a few false promises of money. And I'll go through these fairly quickly. Solomon wrote an awesome book called Ecclesiastes, and he had the most wealth of anybody probably we've ever known in this lifetime. And he had all the things that he could do, and he tried a lot of different things in life to try to find happiness and to build himself, to find significance and those kinds of things. And what ultimately Solomon did is he chose to try to find ways to help let money bring him happiness. And he said these words, "Those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness." The second falsehood is this: significance. That having money somehow makes you somebody. Luke 12:15, he says, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." The third thing is this: we think it's a sense of security, that me having money takes care of me in the long run. And yes, it might financially provide for you a good place, it might provide for your children and for your family and those kinds of things, but it's not the security that God wants us to be concerned about. He says, give up trying so hard to get rich. Your money flies away before you know it, just like an eagle suddenly taken off. So these are false promises: happiness, significance, security. I like this quote from Randy Alcorn. He says, "When earth becomes our heaven," and catch what he's saying, when we make what we are doing right now the totality of our pursuit, when we make this our greatest accomplishment, not our spiritual growth, but what we have here, so when we see God's blessings as primarily immediate and temporal, we lose sight of who we are, why we are here, and what awaits us beyond the horizons of this world. We need to take in the mindset that gets us more thinking about God than our riches. Last week, Andrew did a great job of taking James chapter 5, 19 and 20 and pairing it up with Galatians 6, 1 and 2. And I'm going to do a little bit of that as well. You've heard what James had to say, but look at what 1 Timothy 6, 9 says. He reminds us these same things as Paul is talking to Timothy. He says, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and into a snare, into senseless and harmless desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction." So in other words, that pursuit ultimately provides maybe some things for us, but it also provides for us these other temptations, these pitfalls that we may fall into. And he goes on to say, "For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And it is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." What he's saying is not that money is evil, but he's saying the love of money. And when I thought about this word, I thought, well, you know, is it wrong to love having a little bit or whatever? But it's a different word. If you look into this word, it means this. It means a reprehensible and insatiable desire for wealth, in the sense that I will step on and do whatever it takes to get what I want, that I'm not concerned about anybody else. It's just out for number one. And that kind of insatiable desire to get the next thing, you're never satisfied. It's kind of like I heard people say, you know, they asked Rockefeller years and years and years ago, you know, how much money was enough, and he said $1 more. You're never going to have enough, and this relentless, endless pursuit of money is going to hold us back, because it says ultimately that it is the cause, or it is the root of all kinds of evil. That desire takes us away from a godly mindset. So he says this, and this is when it gets really practical for us. "For the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God." In other words, take our mindset and shift it, not on the riches and the wealth, but on God, who richly blesses us brings us, provides for us everything that we need to enjoy. But then it gets really practical. So what do we do if we have wealth? What do we do if we have resources that we can enjoy and have in our lives? He says those people, those rich people, are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future. And this is talking about eternity, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. In other words, what God is promising in eternity is so much greater than what we have here. And so we find ourselves in this battle. So here's really good advice, step by step, some things that we can do. First of all, he says, be rich in good works. Now, we've studied this in James a bunch. What I'm saying is this is kind of in our own creative mind, recognizing I have resources and seeing a way, or maybe come up with a new way to serve people, to provide a blessing to somebody, to look out for someone else. Those kinds of things are great. So be rich in good works. But also he says, be generous and share. I'm always moved whenever there's a catastrophe that takes place, some kind of difficult circumstance. The Ukraine effort that we had, you know, raised, you guys responded with like $100,000 and maybe even more than that to send over to Ukraine to be a blessing to the Christians that are over there. When Hurricane Ian came down in South Alabama and Florida, you guys rose up. You brought forth your money. You brought forth your possessions and your stuff, and you gave things to the church that we could send those things and be a blessing to other people. It's important that we do that, that we see a need, identify that need, and we respond to it. But then the next part is this, invest spiritually. And I'm going to take just a moment here to ask us, you know, to think about the things that this church supports. And I don't have the list in front of me, but I would encourage all of you to either get a copy of our budget, look at all the minutia, look at all the little details, and see all the many ways and many places and many organizations and many faith-based Christian organizations that we support and that we help. There's really no greater organization that I can think of that does more for the world than the church. And it's interesting that God says we lay by and so we bring those funds together so we can further the kingdom. And so I love that what we give is we give it to the Lord, and then we have these men who are spiritually mature that determine the course of that money, how we can be a blessing to other people. And so these other things that we're talking about, doing good, that's being creative, sharing with people, is recognizing a need and meeting it. But what I'm encouraging all of us to think about is what are we doing giving here at church, investing in things that we have yet to even discover. If you consider that there are still works and opportunities that are out there that we may not have never gone into because we're limited in some way. Like, what if all of us reassessed that? What if all of us gave more and thought about the ways that this church can be a light in the world? Something for us to think about, because he says to us, invest spiritually. And then the next thing is, once you're doing all this, stop and take a moment to recognize the blessings that God has given you. I mean, I think about the song, Count Your Many Blessings. Name them one by one. See how God is blessing you in your life. So here are the action steps for this week. The first one is just what we talked about. Assess your generosity. Look over and see what you're doing. See if there's anything you can do more. See if there are other ways that you can be a blessing to people that you know who are in need. It's not wrong to have the wealth, but when it's become self-indulgent, that's when that part becomes sin in our lives. And so God would say to all of us to be more proactive in looking for ways to share with other people. The second thing is, and this one is super important, is view every day as a gift from God. He says your life is a vapor. You're here one moment and you're gone the next. And then just after that, he says, therefore, let him who knows to do good and does it to him, to know that that is sin itself. What God is promising us is right now. There's no surety of anything beyond this moment right now. And there could be some in our audience this morning who have said, you know, one of these days I'm going to get right. You know, I'm really thinking about this. I'm studying my Bible. And I recognize what I need to do, but I just haven't felt that tug just yet. Let me ask you a question. Do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? If you say yes, the next question is this. Do you believe that he died on the cross for your sins? Yes. So he's the Son of God. He died on the cross for your sins. He paid the price to pay the penalty for your mistakes so you could be washed clean in baptism. And we understand that. We know it's a thing that we need to do, and yet we find like ways to talk ourselves out of it. There's a crowd here. I kind of want to learn a little bit more. I want to straighten some things out in my life. And what I'm saying to you is what God is saying is I will be there with you. But it is now time for you to make that decision. It's not time for you to sit and come up with other excuses for why you won't do it. God has already said, I've done all I can do. It's now up to you to come to me. And I'm begging you to recognize life is a vapor. You have been given today, and it is a special, special gift. What are you going to do for God today? If you're subject to the invitation, please come while together we stand and sing.